In this episode, we speak with David Blake, the co-founder and CEO of Degreed, which is an education technology company that delivers better daily learning experiences with personalized pathways, targeted skill development, data, insights, and reporting. Prior to Degreed, David helped launch a competency-based accredited university and was a founding team member at Zinch. David also co-founded both LearnIn and Book Club. In 2022, he returned as CEO of Degreed when the company acquired LearnIn. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the executive chairman of Market Insight Media and the managing partner of Growth Cap. He is the host of Great Entrepreneurs, a podcast for driven entrepreneurs and business owners. Our podcast covers all topics related to the entrepreneurial journey, from ideation to execution to optimization and to reaping the rewards of a well-run business. In the minutes ahead, we'll share with you unique insights and tactics from some of today's most accomplished and inspiring entrepreneurs.
David, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Where I thought we'd kick off is the edtech space. You've been building Degreed for the past decade or so, maybe more. So you've probably seen how the edtech landscape has evolved. So I'd kind of like to go macro first, and then we'll talk more specifically about Degreed.
Sure. Sounds good.
So how have you seen it evolve? When you first entered the space, I guess in 2012, what did it look like? And I guess, why did you decide to pursue the iteration you were on at that time?
You know, so 2000, just like to sort of set the context for what was going on in 2012. So the ASU GSV conference, which has become the biggest ed tech conference in the world, had its first year in like 2009 or something. And so, I mean, like in terms of just ed tech in this generation, trace it back, whatever that is, sort of 14, 15 years. So edtech as a category was new in 2012, or sort of burgeoning, just sort of emerging. And 2011 was the year of the MOOC. That was the Coursera, Udacity, edX, sort of all launched in 2011. So Degreed launched in 2012, so a year after that. And the problem I really wanted to be working on, which in that moment in time was not yet a thing. No one was talking about it. They say being early is the same thing as being wrong. And Degreed was maybe at risk of just being too early to this problem. And that was credentials. That was the signal behind lifelong learning. Because in 2011, it was all about the content. It was all about democratization of learning. How do we take these college courses and move them online? And we had Khan Academy emerging and others, lynda.com and Pluralsight. I mean, it was this explosion of content of learning, but no one was talking yet about, okay, how are we going to transact on this? How are we going to signal this to the market? And that's what I was deeply passionate about, was creating a signal that could capture all of our lifelong learning.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a pretty broad category of lifelong learning. At that point in time, was it about upskilling or really focusing on people within companies that really needed to be continuously learning, even though that was probably not on the top of their mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's so in the water, so ubiquitous at the moment. When we talk about upskilling and reskilling, it's hard to, again, kind of just step back in time. But no, people were not talking about upskilling in 2012. And I think in large part because learning is the easier problem to solve than upskilling. And to give a quick distinction, because if we're going to try and, you know, talk about a distinction, it's useful to give it. I get on YouTube. Some of the world's best marathon runners have put courses online, have free videos on YouTube. I can go online, I can watch one of those videos, and I learn something. I am more knowledgeable, but it didn't turn me into a marathon runner. Taking a course doesn't just turn you into a marathon runner. And so learning is engaging with the course. Upskilling is actually doing the work to become a marathon runner. And in circa 2012, no one was talking about upskilling. And there was no presumption, certainly no line of sight to the fact that skills would be what people were going to transact on. In that moment in time, Clayton Christensen, you know, talked about courses. We were going to unbundle education and courses would be the unit that people transacted on. They thought, you know, this democratization, this unbundling, oh, now I can take any course from any professor, any university in the world. And looking at your courses is going to be what, you know, the market starts to transact on, which has been partially true, but certainly not true in its totality.
How long did it take before you found product market fit and had confidence that you could scale on that product market fit?
3 years.
And do you remember a distinct signal that you got back saying, okay, this is it?
Yeah, Degreed was pre-revenue for 3 years. And then as we came to market, our first client was about a $20,000 used car dealership network. Our second contract was like a $15,000 contract. And then our third contract was a multi-million dollar global contract with a Fortune 20 company. And so after having just survived this long walk in the desert, you know, against an idea that others didn't yet see or weren't, you know, quite equipped or ready to engage around, sort of all of a sudden, an early adopter took a bet on us. And, you know, that started the dominoes falling. And so for Degreed, we have a very distinct bend in this hockey stick curve, you know, in our story.
And did it all happen in year three? Did all three of those occur in year three, or was it some in like tail end of year two? Or
so Degreed was born January of 2012. And so our first deal we ever closed was fall of 2014. And that big deal was January of 2015. So, I mean, it was, you know, we had a couple of small deals right at the end of year two. And the big one happened, I mean, essentially on our 3 year anniversary.
And then at the time, were you thinking, great, we got the product market fit, we're in the clear, we're just going to execute? And if that was the thought process and if that was the phase you were in, how long did it last before you realized you needed to kind of continue to innovate?
Yeah, I mean, in part because I think if you sort of catch product market fit quickly, early, at some level, you don't actually then have a lot of maturity. I mean, you just haven't built much, you know, and we were maybe unique in that had a strong vision and sense of what I believed the future would look like and stuck to our guns. And so when sort of product market fit, when it finally happened, at some level, we actually had quite a bit of product maturity. And so it really did just, it was sort of like the starting gun of a dead out sprint. And from there, we went from sort of zero to 10 million in ARR in like 14 months.
Wow.
Which, you know, is pretty fast. I don't think, you know, we win any world records or anything, but I think it certainly puts us in a, you know, small kind of upper echelon in terms of that sort of initial ARR growth. So it was a dead out sprint. And it really was about starting to then sort of execute on go to market. It didn't last long because I really feel like we went from no one saw it the way we saw it. No one believed in the future that we were preaching. You know, we were sort of alone out in the wilderness. And then for a moment in time, we were the only game in town. And then that success invites competition. Mm-hmm. And so there was just this brief moment in time where people sort of got it, saw it, and we had no competition. You know, and that was a pretty fun little window of time. And then it, you know, competition steps in and the dynamic changes quite a bit. You know, I think how much time till we were innovating, you know, against sort of anything beyond the really core initial V1 concept, you know, and pretty quickly. I always believe good product innovation, you're kind of layering so that something's always coming online next. It's risky to kind of build behind closed curtains for years at a time and try and do big kind of launches and reveals every few years. Like I really do believe in a just kind of every 6 months you should be layering on kind of the next slice of innovation.
I'd like to go back to the wilderness phase of the journey. Sure. How tough was it? Do you remember if there were moments where you were like, man, I don't even know if this thing is going to work?
When I moved to San Francisco, Silicon Valley, it was kind of the peak of the crushing it culture. Meaning when you were talking to other founders, other entrepreneurs, other executives, when you were at events, the only thing anyone ever said was we're crushing it, you know, and there was like this fear of if you talk about your challenges at all, that it would be perceived as your business is challenged and therefore not going to work. And therefore it's a negative signal, which is going to compound on itself and reinforce and becomes this negative reinforcing truth. And so that was the environment. I did launch very early on with this founder who told me this story about sort of his darkest moment. He was in the shower, started crying, just balled up in a ball in the shower, and was just like crying on the floor of his shower for like 80 minutes and couldn't get back up, couldn't stand up, couldn't get himself out. The water, hot water, you know, ran out. Then it's just cold and he's under cold water in the fetal position on the floor of his bathtub crying. And no one talked like that when I got to Silicon Valley. No one would share kind of their moments like that. And I'm very grateful he did, because inevitably those moments come for you. And yeah, I mean, I have a lot of really hard moments, stories I'm happy to share. I mean, I can point to and name some of those moments, but I was just really grateful for an entrepreneur who, when it wasn't, you know, this is all pre Brené Brown, you know, just when it wasn't cool, chose to be honest and vulnerable with me. And it gave me something. I was like, man, if he had a moment that hard and could get through it, you know, I can too. Like, here's my moment. And I just, you know, I'll come out the other side and get through it.
Yeah, I think it's great how Brian Chesky of Airbnb has been talking about his journey a lot and kind of those moments that he faced.
First 1,000 days of Airbnb, that blog post meant a lot to me early on.
Yeah. And, you know, he really, it seems to be focusing and channeling his experience into the new kind of Airbnb communities and how he's trying to make more connections among people. At that time, did you have a co-founder? Were you able to kind of share in that experience a little bit? So it alleviated maybe any like feeling of I'm alone in this?
Had a co-founder, fantastic, Eric Sharp, had an incredible founding team and cast around me. You know, I appreciated them then. I think, honestly, time has made me all the more grateful and feel all the more lucky to have had kind of that cast. And it really did feel sort of us against the world in it together. And, you know, and I've built two other businesses sort of in the last 10 years as well. And, you know, it hasn't always been the case. I mean, I've gotten to appreciate what it feels like when everyone's truly aligned and in it together. And at times when differences of opinions and whatnot can make people feel like they're pulling against each other rather than with each other.
I noticed that Degreed has grown quickly, and some of it through acquisition. It seems like you really have a coordinated effort and thought process around building the full platform. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've grown it over the last several years?
If I remember this correctly, I think Lean Startup was published in 2014. So I might be off by a year, but right around then, you know, and that's when sort of this pivot came into the zeitgeist of Silicon Valley. And I already told you, we were 3 years to get to revenue. We actually, because of our vision was this portable lifelong learning. If we're ever going to get over college degrees being the only type of education we can transact on in the market, if we're going to get to a more skills-based future where you can transact on lifelong and informal learning, you know, it was going to need to be portable. And so we launched first a consumer, and then we launched our enterprise offering. And I share that in the Lean Startup just to say a lot of people were like, oh, smart pivot, you know, oh, nice pivot, or I see Degreed pivoted. And I call it out just because that always felt frustrating to me, and because we did not follow the Lean Startup playbook. I had a vision, started building against it, held on to that vision with conviction when no one else saw it, kept building, and just survived by the skin of our teeth. But then when the market did sort of see that what our vision of the future had value and was indeed the way things were going, you know, sort of the market and the world caught up to us and magic happened. And I say that because Degreed's now 11 and a half years old, which is, have always had a strong enough sense of what I believe the future needs to look like, that, you know, that's been this North Star that has always given surety and conviction to sort of what needs to be built next. And of course, to find success, you have to bring that back to a market. You have to find dollars, you have to find buyer, you have to find a use case. But I actually think companies can quite easily lose their way, you know, if you orient too much to the market. It's the Henry Ford, you know, ask someone what they want and it's a faster horse. You know, and so I think the way I would frame it is, what if you were to build a university that lasted until you were, you know, 99 years old? and what would have to be true? There's a ton of things that would have to be true or have to be built for that to be a reality. And we've just been slowly asking ourselves that question and building the next thing on the to-do list.
Mm-hmm. You know, I tried to do some research into kind of how the platform can address its target markets or its target users. But where is it most prevalently used? And then how far does it go? Like, what's the breadth of content?
Yeah, so we've built this to be the platform that'll track all of your lifelong learning, academic, professional, and informal learning. And so you have this profile, you know, as the founder, I've been tracking my learning longer than anyone else. But every article, video, book, podcast, course, event, boot camp, certificate program, executive education, degree program, whatever it is, you can track all of it. And then we do the work to, you know, help find signal in that. So what skills have you developed? What are you learning against? What is emerging? What are the adjacencies that you should be thinking about learning or incorporating? The enterprise use case is companies appreciating that people are now learning all the time, and most of it's not happening in their corporate learning management system. They needed a way of being able to see what everyone was learning and to coordinate that. And so that's what Degreed unlocked and Degreed enabled. So our clients tend to be the world's largest companies, in large part because small companies, there can still just be, I think, enough informal intimacy of who knows what, who has what skills, that you don't need as much technology to unlock and enable that. Where at big companies, it's an impossibility. You know, if you have 350,000 employees, there's no way of systematically seeing the skills of the organization. And so that's what Degreed has unlocked for our clients. You know, the challenge with skills, let me give you one quick story, because I think this frames it up really quick. There's a company, Marlin Steel. They've been covered by the Washington Post over several years. The transformation of their business, they're a steel manufacturing company. They make the wire baskets for bakeries to put their bread in. And they created a skills matrix. Every employee on one axis, 135 micro skills on the other axis, and then rated every employee between 0 and 4 on each micro skill. And every time any employee would level up, they got a micro raise. And they pointed this skills matrix as transforming their business, the lives of their employees, up-leveling the employees, therefore up-leveling the capabilities of the organization, and true just sort of transformation. But the challenge is, I mean, they have dozens of employees, not hundreds, you know, not thousands, not tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands. They have dozens of employees. And they did this over 135 skills, micro skills. And so when you think about doing that at scale, it's an impossibility up until this moment. And with the democratization of AI, all of a sudden, there's the computational capabilities to be able to think about what a skills matrix looks like for a company with 200,000 employees. And we're in this really exciting moment where all of a sudden AI is the tool that is allowing us to look at massive amounts of data and signal on each person and to be able to bring back with enough surety and certainty the skill profile of each employee. And that's going to unlock a whole new way for organizations to be able to operate. Right now, you know, you might have 500 employees with the same job title, same compensation, but of course, 500 people don't actually have the same skill sets, you know, but we have to treat them uniformly because we organize companies today by job role, job title. And we're about to unlock this future where organizations are going to be able to discern the different skills between those 500 people and to actually be able to organize the work in a way that accounts for it, you know, is match makes on it and gets the ultimate amount of leverage from each individual person. And, you know, that's an exciting and better future.
You mentioned the transition towards enterprise customers from individual consumers. Have you fully transitioned over, or do you still have direct consumer products and solutions?
Yeah, an interesting question with all that lies kind of behind that. You can still sign up for Degreed for free as a consumer. And as an enterprise end user, if you ever leave the client where you are using Degreed, you can take your profile and your data with you. And so we are a very unique sort of enterprise SaaS company in that our end user owns their data, and there is this portability and lifelong aspect to our platform.
What about reskilling? Like, what if you're in a current career path and you're like, I'd like to learn how to do something else, but that's not really in the purview of the current organization you're in. So Is that even a possibility, or you're kind of put on this track?
No, I mean, that's a lot of what, you know, it's good for the employee and it's good for the employer ultimately, which is if you pulled up most companies' kind of career pathing, it looks like a subway map. You know, it's like, you are here. Okay. You know, at this station, there's two train tracks forging ahead. Those might fork once or twice. And ultimately, you might be able to consider or end up as one of 4, 6, 8 different roles or jobs on one of these kind of two career paths. Mm-hmm. But as you get to skills, it becomes about matchmaking. All right, here's every job inside of the organization. Here is the skills required for every job in the organization. And then here's the skills you have. And we will show you how qualified or not you are against every role. And so you can pick any role and say, okay, here's the skills I have, here's the skills I need. And if I were to work on this, you know, bundle of skills, I could qualify myself for this totally different thing off in a whole nother direction. And it's unlocking kind of that future. And so that's pretty cool. And for the most part, organizations are actually embracing of that future. They don't see it really as threatening. They see it as a chance to retain people longer in a world that, you know, the average job tenure has gotten very short. I think people know they've got to give kind of that growth opportunity or risk just losing people altogether.
Within the realm of the entrepreneurship topic, what's the best advice you've ever received, or what's the best insight you could provide to other entrepreneurs?
I'll give you two. I repeat to myself and out loud a lot of the principles and advice I've gotten along the way, and some really have stuck with me, and I use them, you know, daily, weekly to guide myself and my decision-making in the organization. So the first is from Ann Duane, who is now one of the founding managing directors of Village Global. She was the first CEO that I worked for at a startup. And her saying is, you know, in startups, when there's 1,000 things that need to get done, how do you know which one to work on? And the advice is manage to the constraint. How quickly the constraint changes is how good of a job you're doing at management. I never feel at loss of what to do, or if I do, I'd always go back to that guidance, that advice, and it's always served me well and just feeling grounded in which piece of it to work on next. And then the latter is, you talked a little bit about just the kind of hardships of the entrepreneurship journey. I don't remember who gave me this advice, but they said 50% of the job is managing your own psychology. And that one I've just found to be deeply true and something I come back to a lot.
Awesome. Okay. Last two questions. One, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
Yeah. Chris Iyer is the very first investor into Greed. And after I got rejected by sort of every VC that I pitched, which was most of them, you know, he was willing to take a chance on me. And he said, look, I'm going to write you a $50,000 check. He said, just watch. Often all it takes is one person to believe and it changes everything. And sure enough, it was true. He wrote me a check, and others then had the courage and willingness to kind of be a first follower. But it changed everything for me.
Last question. Can you tell us about a charity, cause, or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Yeah, I actually stepped down as CEO of Degreed for 2 years to start a nonprofit called Americans for Common Ground. My wife has started a nonprofit called Tech Moms, which is career switching and career entry for women into tech fields. I sit on a board of a nonprofit called Top of the Hill Girls Secondary School, which is building schools for girls in Kenya. You know, all three of those have a common theme, which is, you know, really do believe in a world where we've got to come together. Education is one of the great levers in the world, and hope to be sort of a force for good in all those directions.
Awesome. Well, David, this was a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you again for taking the time.
I appreciate it.